Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Gar Alperovitz, who is a historian, a political economist, and an activist and a writer. He is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. His latest book is called What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Gar Alperovitz, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me, David.
So this is a wonderful book, a provocative book, and the first section of it makes a powerful case that we're up against problems that are deep and long-term and require more than the usual level of change. Can you explain to listeners what you mean?
Well, the argument is that it is a systemic crisis, deeply, that you need to change the system to solve some of the problems, rather than simply a traditional political crisis. So a simple way to say that is, for instance, over 30 years, the top 1% has gone from having 10% of the income to 20%, some years 22, which means the bottom 99% have lost that. Now, notice that's 30 years, and you've had different presidents. It's not just about the Republicans blocking things in the House. You've had Democrats, Republicans. Something much more powerful is driving a trend like that, and it's in the corporate system.
So this is a trend that continues regardless of the political party in the White House. It doesn't go up and then down again and up again.
By and large, that's what's happening. Same in for instance, in CO2 production. It's gone up 30% in the last 30 years. So, and again, in and out doesn't much matter who's in office. Now, that's not entirely true, but by and large, if you look at income inequality, wealth, big environmental trends, civil liberties steadily getting worse no matter who's in office. Obama came in saying he was going to do more in this area. They've become more intrusive, and the decisions by the White House have become more secretive. The infringements on people's privacy have become greater, not less. So the long trends, and we could go down the list, and in the book, in What Then Must We Do, I kind of give a whole series of these trends that tell you that you're looking at much more powerful things than what we usually take for granted. That doesn't mean we should stop doing politics. Holding back the trends as best we can is important. But clearly, if we're going to get anywhere, you've got to essentially change the system. And then the question is, what is that about? What can we look to that begins to move in that direction? How do we make it practical rather than rhetorical? And how do we get serious about step-by-step laying the groundwork for some kind of larger transformation based on American principles and American experience?
I think incarceration rates was another one of those trends, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary one because it tells you a great deal about real liberty, or depriving people of liberty. It's gone from about 90 people per 100,000 in prison 30 years ago, somewhere up near 753, 780, as I recall the numbers. So over 30 years, that steady expansion, and largely, and not entirely, but largely black and brown. And it's seven times more people in prison in the United States per capita than in any other advanced system, including Russia. I mean, we are way off the charts, and people talk about this, the land of liberty, but the trends, again, tell you something different's going on at a very profound level, which really requires looking much deeper than we normally look in politics.
So where do we look? What specifically do we need to change?
Well, the argument of the book, and it's written, as you know, in a kind of very conversational way, but it's based on a long research project we have. The argument is that most systems are based, not surprisingly, on who controls wealth, because wealth gives power. So, for instance, feudal systems, it was land gave the lords and the king and the church power. In state socialism, the state got the power and concentrated it. We live in a corporate system and owned by very tiny elites. I mean, the number that really is a kind of eye-opener is 400 people, 400 individuals, you could get them on a large airplane, have more wealth than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. You just have to let that one sit there. I've mentioned it in the talk recently. I said, you know, that's the that's a medieval number. That's how power was concentrated and wealth was power was concentrated that much in medieval times. And a medieval historian came up to me afterwards and said, no, it was never that concentrated. This is a new phenomenon. Medieval was concentrated, but not to that degree.
That's remarkable.
And because of that, let's say it's remarkable. And that tells you a lot about where the real power is in Washington, the corporate power. Now, it's not, I wouldn't want to oversimplify it. There's, you know, that tells you a lot, doesn't tell you everything. There are ways to make indentions and breakthrough on that. But one of the things that has held that power in line and the corporations that go along with it traditionally has been a politics that both was organized by activists but also had institutions, and most importantly, not only the United States but throughout Western Europe, labor unions and around the world. And they always gave strength of some kind, not in every area but in some major areas, to a progressive politics. And one of the things that really has happened and why the system problem is so now dramatic and clear, labor unions have gone way down in power. They've gone from 35% of the labor force at the peak just after World War II. They're now down to 11% in general, 6% in the private sector, and going weakening. So we're in a systemic crisis that there's really no institutional way to hold back the power of the corporations and the elites. Until we build something new. But that means changing the system in some practical way over time, in a way that, for one thing, just has to change that concentration of wealth in some democratic way. Democratizing wealth becomes one of the key problems that we need to solve, or the power base of the existing system just continues to crush the trends.
And in the book, you give numerous examples of possible partial solutions, steps in the right direction, usually at the local or state level. What are some of the directions we might want to be looking at?
Well, that's the interesting thing, and it's the main coverage of the book, which is, you know, people think, can this be done? And the fact is that the newspapers don't cover what's going on at the grassroots level particularly. They're not interested, and they're in financial difficulties. They don't have reporters. They fired a lot of staff. They're conservative. But if you actually look at what's going on around the country, there's an explosion of new forms, very American in nature, that really take over ownership of wealth at different levels. So let me give you an example. And it's very decentralized. It's not state control like Soviet Union control of the economy. But it is democratically owned wealth. So most people don't know that there are 130 million Americans who are members of co-ops. And credit unions is a co-op. It's part of that. Or there's another 10,000 worker-owned companies in the United States. And they're expanding around the country. People don't know about the Bank of North Dakota, which is a socialist bank right there for 90 years in 20 states are trying to do something similar. There are many, many cities, 2,000 cities, where the city owns the electric utility. In fact, 25% of American electricity currently is socialized. It's either by a public utility or co-ops. And land ownership is changing from neighborhood ownership, from instead of private neighborhood ownership through a cooperative land trust, or city ownership is expanding all over the country. So there are many, many things on the ground, and we can go to the state and national level as well, where 27 states now have state ownership of parts of companies. That is, the public owns a piece of businesses. There are many, many things that the press doesn't cover that are beginning to point the way, and they're expanding and growing, towards a very different vision of what might be a democratic way to own an economy, run an economy, and a different power base also for politics. And the book is really, as I say, it's written in a very informal way, but it's based on a lot of research on this explosion around the country that points a new direction and gives an idea of where we could go if we got into a politics that actually also advanced this direction, took it seriously. It sort of reminds me of the just before the New Deal in the 1920s, all kinds of experiments going on in the state, what they used to call the state and local, quote, laboratories of democracy. And all the things going on at the lower level, boom, when the time came right, became the architecture, expanded architecture at a higher level of what New Deal programs became. And I think if you look at what's going on around the country just below the surface, you see the preliminary outlines of what looks to be pointing towards a different system that is basically anchored in a different form of ownership, but very American in style, very democratic, very decentralized. We have time, we can talk about some of the national possibilities are much larger level already, too. But that's the thrust of the book, is for saying these are things you can do as well in your area. If somebody's doing it in a city like Cleveland, which is a very interesting city in this regard, very difficult economic situation, but they're doing very creative things with worker-owned companies and a quite large scale. If you can do it in Cleveland, you can do it almost any place. So in a sense, the book puts it right on the table to any activists who are serious. You can do this if you want to, and the question is you learn about it and try to emulate what's being done in other places around the country.
We're speaking with Gar Alperovitz about his book, What Then Must We Do? And I have read a number of books that tried to collect inspiring examples like these from around the country, but this was probably the best collection that I've read, and I highly recommend it. And one thing that struck me that I was completely unfamiliar with, and that apparently is happening even here in my state of Virginia, which we never get to have any good news about, is a creation of a different kind of corporation called B Corps or B Corporations. That you describe what makes these corporations different.
Well, again, it's another one of these examples of moving towards ownership that has a public purpose. Under ordinary corporate law, if you are a kind of the chief executive officer of a corporation, and if you start spending corporate money on helping the community, doing environmentally useful good things that you don't have to do, spending money on improving the kind of city or helping out low-income groups, you are subject to attack by your stockholders for wasting the company's money legally. So you're not allowed to. You can do a little bit token if you can claim it's public relations. Or similarly, and this is what's happened with Ben & Jerry's, if you're trying to run a company on different social principles and you get an offer for a buyout that will help the stockholders of your company from big internet multinational that wants to take you over, you have to accept that, or you're subject to attack if it's the best offer. Well, a B Corp, and now there are, I think, 12 states have passed this, is just a wrinkle in the law that says, and it's easy to pass, and many states are now doing it, if you set up your corporation as a specialized corporation, the only difference is in a B Corp is going in, the stockholders know that you are going to do social purposes. So you can't then be sued if you do them. And going in, they know you're not going to take the best price, even if you sell it out, even if it violates the environmental and other concerns you have. So that's a B Corp protects social purposes of the company and gives it a very different thrust. And that's another part of this trend where trying to find a way to change the institutional structure, not just we got to do politics and activism and elections, but unless we change the structure of power institutionally that moves in a different direction, we're going to continue to be in the bind we're in. And this is just another example of what's popping up around the country. And largely because there's a lot of pain out there. It isn't just that people want to do this. There's environmental concerns. There's social and economic pain is growing. And out of that, I think, people are being forced to innovate, and I think that's why these kinds of trends are likely to continue, not simply because they're good things to do, but because it's very hard to do the traditional things and solve problems. People are being forced to innovate and create new institutions, most importantly characterized by changing who gets to own or the purposes of owning capital or goods or companies.
I used to work in an arm of the AFL-CIO, and the office next door was a part of the labor movement called Union Label, and they maintained a website and information to refer people to where you could buy any sort of product or service union made, if possible. Is there anyone collecting a way for people to support worker-owned businesses and B Corps and other more democratic sorts of institutions? Is there a way to find out where you can support such things as a consumer?
You know, I saw that in something you've written, and I thought that's a terrific idea, like the Union Label. I don't know of any place that does it, but I think it's a great idea that ought to be done. And indeed, we should get the word around and begin to push it, because I think that would actually help popularize and develop the idea. It's a great thought.
Well, somebody listening to this program is going to have to pick that up and do it, because we don't have the time, but we need it done. So all these wonderful local and state level examples, you mentioned the word national there. How in the world do we take something this good and make it national? Clearly, it can't stay under the radar and go unnoticed if it succeeds at the level, you know, we can't end up with workers owning everything without anybody noticing. And I'm not clear on how you keep the national political system, corrupt as it is, from shutting down or even reversing this good trend as it has so many other good trends.
Well, it's important to realize that in local communities where the pain level is really high, and I mentioned Cleveland is an example, but you find this in many, even so-called conservative communities, and we've seen this even in some communities in Texas, where the pain level's high and there aren't any answers, you even find at the local level so-called small-c conservatives, that is not ideologues like the Rush Limbaugh and the guys who just make a living by spouting rhetoric, but people just live in town and kind of small business people, they are for, not against, worker ownership, which is an odd thing to find out. They think it's practical. People get to own something. It helps the community. This is a very down-home quality that surprisingly cuts across many ideological lines at the local and state level. So building up constituencies that... it helps the local small businessman if you improve the community economy. This is not quite as obvious, the politics of it. Indeed, some conservatives have been for worker ownership for a long time. In fact, Ronald Reagan is on record as been endorsing it. So it's an odd politics that doesn't cut quite the same way. On the other hand, you're right that if it built up strongly, you would begin to see some reactions. But over time, we'll see. The things that I think are interesting at the national level, where there are also some powerful crises developing within certain sectors that are slightly different kind of dynamics. So, for instance, the healthcare system, even with Obamacare now in place, is a system out of control financially and in terms of costs. And what's happening, you can see it already beginning to get, as we get closer to implementation of Obamacare, some of the corporations are trying to get people off the rolls. They're investing in what they call skinny policies, very weak insurance policies. You're going to see other people who are not going to be treated because the costs are going to be too high. There'll be technical ways to throw people out of the system or give them something, but not really enough to be handled. So the problems of a very, very jury-rigged system with insurance companies and doctors and hospitals, everybody making money if somebody gets sick, are going to hit the road as this gets implemented around the country, state by state by state. And I think in that situation, I think you're going to see politics developing to go to the only answer that really is available, which is a single-payer system. Now, Vermont is on the verge of doing it. They'll do it in 2014. California passed it twice, and I think it's going to, not this year, but I think it'll come back in the next couple of years again in California because of the internal problems of the system being insoluble, and because we're going to see a lot of people in pain around the country. I think you're going to see a dynamic over time to shift that whole system in a new way. Public kind of single-payer is simply a democratically owned, publicly owned insurance company. That's all it is. And it's another form of democratizing ownership. When you take it over, say, in the state of Vermont, you displace the private insurance companies. And I think we're going to see it agonizingly, slowly, state by state by state, as the problems get worse. And that's a big deal. You're talking, over time, of almost 20% of the U.S. economy. So it is not a small sector. It's not just grassroots things. There are other things going on in the banking sector, which we could talk about, that also point towards crisis changes that are likely to begin moving the ball. And as I mentioned earlier, 20 states have introduced legislation to do what's been done for 90 years in North Dakota, where there's a public bank. Again, it's interesting because I've talked around the country about the book and about what then must we do. People simply just don't know about a lot of this. They don't know that there's a public bank in North Dakota, or that there are 10,000 worker-owned companies, or that people are doing this in other places. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is simply to kind of help people understand you can actually do this, too, in your own area. They are doing it elsewhere, but the press isn't covering it. And that's really an important thing to know, that the press hasn't been covering something that is quietly building up in many parts of the country that other people can do, and we can incorporate it in movement building as well.
Well, I think that is important and inspiring. To a little bit of devil's advocate, however, you know, the state of California passed single payer repeatedly when there was a Republican governor who had promised to veto it. The Democratic Assembly passed it repeatedly. As soon as they got a Democratic governor who avoided committing to signing it, even while campaigning for office, the assembly not wanting to embarrass that governor by forcing him to sign it or veto it, chose not to pass it anymore. And a half dozen assembly members who took money from insurance companies switched their votes. Numerous people said that there was pressure from Washington to switch votes. And even the advocacy, or even the nurses and the doctors' organizations, the big leaders of the activist push for single payer, said, we're not going to push it again because it would fail and that would weaken us, as if not bringing it up at all doesn't weaken you further. And so there seems to be, and in other states, there was much more of a drive for single payer at the state level before Obamacare happened. Now there seems to be quite a lot of pushback, or at least we need to wait 5 years and see.
Well, that's you're absolutely right, and a good part of the in California, the Obama administration was really down on the Democratic Party and saying don't let this happen because Obamacare is coming in. But the argument is not, and I accept that. The argument is that once you put in Obamacare, even with which I'm for, I think it's an advance. It's certainly not, I would go much further, obviously, but it's much better than, maybe there are 30 million people who will be helped, and it's much better than where we've been. But once it is in place, then I think you're going to begin to see some of these problems that can't be solved without a single-payer system. So I think the pain levels are going to resume. And piece by piece, I think we're going to begin to see, and it is over the next 5 years. And the argument of this book really is a systemic crisis is one that is going to be forcing these issues for the next decade or beyond. It isn't like we're not going to snap your fingers and make it happen. So, yes, it's true that there is resistance in many states to single payer in general, and in specific, California is an example, because of Obamacare. But that doesn't remove the problems. The problems are going to continue and to deepen thereafter, in my view, and in the view of many experts. And then if you look carefully at it, really the only way out of it is a single-payer system going to get to the heart of the problem. But we'll see. I think we'll see. Vermont's going to be the first test case on this. Probably Connecticut will be second.
I think there are a couple big solutions that a lot of people have in mind when they look at these trends of massive inequality and disempowerment. And I think that I still have a couple big ideas in mind, to which I add worker ownership and the kind of ideas that come out of your book as a sort of a third strategy without replacing the others. And one of those is taxing the billionaires, taxing the centimillionaires, taking those 400 people who you can read about on Forbes magazine's website with all the information of where they inherited their wealth and so forth, and taxing the bejesus out of them, which your book seems a little dismissive of. And the second, which your book seems not to mention at all, is where National Priorities Project says 57% of federal discretionary spending now goes, that is, war and war preparation, which, as I understand it, is a drain, not a boost to the economy. What about cutting the military? What about taxing the rich?
Well, it's interesting. As you probably know, I've been involved at various levels, both in the left politics and progressive politics, and running House and Senate staffs and anti-war movement at various points. And I'll take whatever I can get on those fronts. Let me put it that way. Taxing at the highest level, and I've written many articles on this, is critical and very important if you can do it. And cutting the military budget and cutting these wars that are ridiculous and outrageous and immoral is critical. And getting rid of the nuclear weapons, which I've written a lot about, as you probably know, a couple books about it. My conclusion is that we have to do whatever we can on that front. But the truth is, we haven't had the institutional base to do any serious taxing at the top until we rebuild a whole new institutional power base. Now that the unions are going down, we're going to be in a dead end on the question of whether or not we can cut into the taxes. I'm for whatever we can get. But one of the reasons we're talking about the ownership structures, co-ops, and changing the banking structure, like the Bank of North Dakota, and maybe some of the big banks as well, changing the ownership of healthcare. We're also changing where the institutional power base locally begins to build up that can be part and parcel of the new politics that builds, in the way that unions were part and parcel of the old politics, that gives movement building a different anchor and a different strength. I think we're going to have to go through that process before we can really take on the obvious necessity of taxing the top groups. I'm not against that at all. I think the problem, though, is our politics has been so weakened that we're into a whole different model until we can rebuild. On the military issues, again, whatever we can get, and I think we're in a long trend, hopefully, where we're going to begin resisting more and more of these murderous wars slowly over time. There has been a relative decline in military spending as a percentage of the economy over time, either measured as direct military expenditures or including the 57%. So slowly that's happening, not fast enough, clearly, for my purposes, but nonetheless, it shows you another area where we can, if we mobilize, we can. I'm totally with you on that. That needs to be taken on. The thrust of this book is we've got to change the institutional substructure of the whole system in general if we want to make real changes at the level of, you know, most of the issues that we're talking about, because we need a new power base, as well as a new vision of what kind of an economy should be owned democratically. So it's walk on two legs. Do whatever we can now in the old way, taxing, cutting back, going back against the military budget, but also really recognizing we need to rebuild a whole different system and based on different principles, and recognizing that and slowly you're beginning to see it happen in many parts of the country, and that the trends are likely to continue because we're failing, because of the pain levels, because of the difficulties, and therefore we have an opportunity maybe to actually build on the context that's allowing all this.
I wish we could continue this conversation. We are running out of time, but for those of you who have grasped the importance of this idea, please check out Gar Alpervit's new book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Gar, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks very much, David, for having me. Appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.